No, the interesting work about healing energy and in the energy healing experiments, Dr. Gary Schwartz talks about it, is that these are things which we don't necessarily see, but we can feel. So is it part of our ordinary world on a day-to-day basis, or is it an extraordinary part of our world into which we rarely actually travel? I'd like to talk about that amongst about a billion other things with Dr. Gary Schwartz. But first, let's establish your credentials, if we can, Dr. Schwartz, okay? I have. Are you still with the University of Arizona?
That's correct.
All right. Say check next to everything that you are either at least conversant in, if not an expert in, okay? Psychiatry.
Yes.
Healing energies.
Yes.
Medicine.
A bit.
Automotive repair.
Not at all.
Okay. Neurology.
What did you say? Neurology? Yes.
Neurology.
Yes.
Okay. Psychiatry.
That you already asked? You just checked to see if I give it.
Oh, wait. Yeah, exactly. I was just trying to fool you. Interpretive dance.
Actually, I once did a study on interpretive dance.
See? I'm telling you. I was just throwing these out thinking there's no way. But, okay, so I got one. Interior design.
Not at all.
Okay. Surgery.
A little.
Surgery, a little bit. All right, so as I understand it, you're a professor for just about everything at the University of Arizona except English and French. Is that fair?
Not interior design.
And not interior design.
That's correct.
But this is part of why this is such a unique opportunity to talk about something like this with you. Lots of people can put this on a website. A lot of people can, you know, just kind of give you a feeling that they have while they're, you know, taking money from you at a storefront somewhere. But to have somebody with the credentials that you have and the amount of time that you've put into the subject, that is what's going to make this show tonight. We'll get to it right away. The energy healing experiments, and we'll talk about the transplants coming up next with Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Gary Schwartz, it should probably just be a matter of course. I'll admit up front that I grew up in a household which was very friendly to the discussion of healing energies.
Oh.
So it's not a leap at all for me to consider these sorts of things. I haven't always seen the proof of those beliefs, but I'm always open to them, so I just loved your book.
Well, that's fantastic. I sort of wish that I had grown up in a home that was open to this. I mean, for me, this was very much a surprise that I would end up doing work in this area, or that we'd actually end up doing experiments that would actually provide such positive evidence for the phenomenon.
Well, and there's lots of these test results and other things that I want to get to, and I know that the phones are going to be jammed for you, too, coming up later on, so I want to make the most of the time that I have with you. Let me start with that. The premise, though, you got into this how? I mean, you come into medicine from a fairly traditional background. How did you first kind of cross the line into this area, which some people would consider, you know, parapsychological or paranormal?
Sure. Well, I think part of it comes from the conventional, if you would, physics and electrical engineering, and part of it comes from a circumstance of actually meeting some healers and witnessing some phenomena that I just couldn't—I couldn't even have imagined it. My earliest experience was actually when I was a child. I was 6 or 7 years old, and my parents had just gotten a new television set, and this was a long time ago. This was one of those black and white television sets, you know, in a wooden box.
Sure.
And they used do you remember rabbit ears?
Of course, I still have them. I have a set with still has rabbit ears.
Really, that's fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you.
And the you probably remember or know of that in those days we had a lot of channels, like maybe 2 or 3.
Right.
And if you were going to change the channel, you actually had to get up out of your chair.
Right.
To turn the dial. This was a long time ago. And one of the things I observed as a kid when I walked near the television set, that the image would often get distorted, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. I was a curious kid. And so I started playing with the rabbit ears antenna and noticed that there was a wire, and it was screwed into the back of the TV. And my father had a toolbox, and I knew where it was, and so I took out a screwdriver, and I unscrewed the wire. Of course, the picture disappeared. And then I took my finger, and I touched the screw, you know, on the back of the TV.
Sure.
And then I looked at the TV in the front of the picture, And to my amazement, I saw the picture return. I let go of my finger, and the picture disappeared. And I reattached my finger, and the picture reappeared. And I did it over and over, and I realized that I was serving as a rabbit ears. I was somehow serving as an antenna for signals I could not see, I could not imagine. And yet, I was part of the process. Now, being, again, a questioning kid, I didn't know if this was real or not. My parents had an AM radio. Again, it was one of those old radios, a big one with a big dial, wooden box. And it had a long wire that was hid behind the couch. I unscrewed that wire, and the sound disappeared, music disappeared. I touched the back of the screw, and lo and behold, the music appeared. So what happened was I had, so to speak, a scientific, mystical experience with this realization that somehow I, and therefore everyone else, was serving as an antenna and even potentially a receiver for invisible signals that I couldn't imagine. So I think what started me on the road to being interested in science and being interested in energy, particularly invisible energy, was that very early childhood experience.
And how many years later was it while did you still have to stand there and be a human antenna for your father?
Well, in some respects, it's never ended.
And that's how you got into psychiatry. You're still dealing with all of those issues.
Exactly. That's very funny. But it really wasn't until many years later, when I was an established, scientist. I had done my PhD at Harvard. I had been a professor at Harvard and also at Yale, and then moved to the University of Arizona. And it wasn't until after that that I started witnessing healing. I had never thought that I'd actually be using this in a healing context. And I describe in the Energy Healing Experiments book, for example, an experience I had with a healer who I call Suzanne in the book, on the East Coast. And she was actually a clinical psychologist who was just learning about healing touch. This was in the mid-1990s. And a patient of hers called, very upset. It was a lawyer, and her husband had fallen off the roof. And he was in an emergency room, and he was in severe pain. And so Suzanne went to the hospital, and I was invited to come along. And he was in a room by himself, hadn't had any medication yet, hadn't been x-rayed, severe pain. And Suzanne said to me, she said, Gary, would you mind taking his wife out and giving her some comfort? And I'm going to see if I can do some healing energy with him. Of course, I didn't know what this was. So I took the gentleman's wife out. But I positioned her in such a way that I could look over her shoulder to see what Suzanne was doing. And I noticed that Suzanne was, for example, taking her hands, not touching the man's body, but just sort of passing it over his head and other parts of his body. And then she took her hand and she sort of waved it near the man's wrist. She actually took her finger, I later learned it's called the laser technique, and pointed it and actually drilled. And the image that I had when she was sort of drilling in the air was, what happens when you take your finger and you put it near your head as if somebody's crazy?
Right.
Well, that's the image that I had. Anyway, I came back into the room 15 minutes later with the wife, and there is the man smiling like a Cheshire cat. And he had claimed that his pain had virtually disappeared. Virtually disappeared. Now, no, he was not about to play tennis. He ultimately did have a broken wrist. But his pain had vanished. And the question that I had was, where did his pain go? Was this just some sort of massive placebo effect? Was this would have just have gone away by itself? Or was Suzanne doing something with her energy and with her consciousness that was contributing to his pain relief?
But now, in a way, aren't those kind of two different things? Okay. I mean, the idea of, with energy, reading your book, too, I was just fascinated with the different versions of different approaches you had to this, but let's just stay with the energy.
Sure.
If it's something that she's transmitting
right.
from her body to his body at a cellular level,
right.
that's one thing. But the conscious part of it, too, can be something else, can't it? I mean, just the very thought, for example, just I'll talk off the top of my head, that she was there and caring for him
right.
and demonstrating affection and no fear of his injuries and calming him and distracting him from his pain, could that not just be enough to increase, say, his natural endorphin level and therefore making the pain go away?
Absolutely. In fact, that was one of the fundamental questions Was it just simply her loving and comforting presence? Or was it something more than that? Was it actually involving her energy and maybe even her conscious intentions, which, by the way, and the later point in the book I talk about this, where she could actually be doing this long distance. With the, you know, healings where, and I report this early in the book, where healings could take place hundreds or thousands of miles away, and where the, even in certain cases where the patient isn't even conscious that the healing intentions are being provided.
And that speaks to the E. coli experiment in your book, which we can go back to, too. But I want to make that point. That there's something about her demeanor that adds to the effect. And so when you say, is it a placebo effect, would it be unfair to call it a placebo effect if he feels like he's getting better because he just likes the feeling of being around her?
Yes, we should define what placebo means. That's what psychiatrists or psychologists typically call it, but really it's any factor that is relates to belief or relates to the people's awareness of the social experience. In other words, it's the, if you would, the psychological side of healing as opposed to a possible energetic side as well. And as you know, what the book does is actually, much to my amazement, discovers that there's more to human relationship than just the psychology of our relationship, but there's an actual energetic role as well.
The physiology of our relationships.
The physiology of a relationship, but also the actual invisible energy of the relationship.
Right, right. But and that's where the thing is that on this is what we're really talking about is something that is not otherworldly. It's just this worldly. We just don't spend a lot of time with it. We don't think about it. We're not
exactly
open
it's the
to
same
it.
Thing. That's why I go back to the TV signals, okay, or the fact that I'm in Tucson, Arizona. Where are you located?
I'm in Minneapolis, St. Paul.
Okay. And somehow we are communicating over long distance, and probably some of this communication is certainly to your listeners going out over the, quote, radio waves.
Right.
This is not otherworldly. This is obviously part of the our natural environment. But those signals are, quote, invisible. They're invisible to our senses. And if it, until this, you know, until radio was discovered, we never knew that there were these invisible means by which energy and information could transmit over long distances.
Yeah, but there's something about that, the fact that what you're doing here with the work is quantifiable. You can measure it. You can,
absolutely,
like any good scientist, you can repeat the results, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's the difference between just somebody handing you a stone and or a crystal and saying, here, this is all you need. There's, you know, and or charging you a lot of money for something, which in the end, you kind of didn't feel like there really was any appreciable difference in your life. There's something about what you're doing, which is just, it really kind of puts some a handle on it for a lot of people out there who would never have given this another thought.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that we do in this book is we lay out a whole series of real experiments, you know, not just with healers, but with normal everyday folks, including undergraduate students,
yeah,
and actually study to what extent, for example, can one person objectively measure the energy of another person, sense the energy of another person.
And I'm sorry, since when are undergraduate students normal people? I don't,
well,
when did that
I
happen?
I have to put normal in quotes.
When did that happen? When I was in school. Do they suddenly straighten up after I left? Is that it?
Yeah, well, I hopefully they're as, quote, unnormal as your listenership, which,
okay,
is probably among the more creative of our population.
I think so, too. And all right, so let's talk about one of these experiments. Give an example of a kind of experiment you could do that would prove that, you know, you gave your observation about the woman and your friend, and that's cool. But all right, so let's where did the rubber hit the road on this? How can you prove that her twirling of her finger over an injury would create a some sort of subatomic healing process?
Okay. Well, let's start with the first question, which is whether or not, for example, if we move our hands or move any part of our body in a particular way, are we actually generating an electromagnetic field? Is that electromagnetic field, does that travel across from one person to another? And can the other person serve as an antenna for this kind of a signal? And I describe in the book experiments we did where we actually had people under controlled conditions moving their hands a fixed distance in space, up and down, I think it was 3 or 4 inches. The exact distance is not important at this moment. And they would move it up and down, over an electrode box, which is where, for example, EEG electrodes would be attached. So notice right now what we're doing is we're dealing with the electrode box itself. There are no electrodes actually attached to the box. The box is just sitting there. But that box, by wire, of course, is plugged into this very sensitive microvolt amplifier. And what we predicted was that due to what's called an electrostatic body motion effect, that when a person would move their hand up and down, that this would actually create a magnetic field. And that magnetic field would actually be picked up, would travel through the air, reach the place where the holes were, where the wire would actually plug in. It would then be carried by the wire into the amplifier, because remember, this electrode box has wires that go into the input of the amplifiers. And then this would actually be displayed on the screen. And you could actually document very beautifully that to move is to create an electromagnetic field. Now, once you've documented that occurs, and that's easily replicable, then the next thing to do is the question is, to what extent can another person actually be picking up that signal? So, for example, when you move your hand, let's say, up and down over a person's head, does their head actually pick up that signal? And is that signal transferred through the person's body? And we actually did experiments where we show one of the things that happens with normal electrical signals is that it decreases with what's called the square of the distance. In other words, the further you move away from an antenna, the smaller the signal is that reaches the antenna. And you can actually show that it decreases over distance, which we did. Then what we did was we showed that if a subject, in this case the antenna person, took and put their hands over the antenna, over the electrode box, but were not touching it. And now the sender waved his hand up and down either over the person's head or over their other hand that was 3 or 4 feet away from the actual antenna box. You would see a dramatic increase in the size of the signal, which then told us that the person was actually receiving the signal, not just the one who was generating it, but the other person was receiving it. It was traveling through their body and then being picked up by the actual electromagnetic amplifiers. So here we're starting with a very simple but elegant way to verify that these signals are connecting us all the time, and this is just one of a variety of electrical signals which most of us are aware of. By the way, one of my all-time favorite experiences was, which is again, this is now an anecdote, but it's easy to replicate, was that I was wanting to see how many different kinds of amplifiers could pick up these signals, and as I'm sure you're aware, there are now miniaturized digital, for example, EEG or EKG amplifiers that are used in biofeedback, and they can plug into a normal PC, and you can actually use these kind of amplifiers. They only cost a couple of $100, and I wanted to try one of these myself. And I was doing this in my study with a former colleague of mine, and she was on the other end of the room, and I was serving. She was the sender, and I was the antenna, and we were getting results. And then her little dog came into the room. He was a little West Highland white terrier, whose name, by the way, was Freudy. It was actually Freudy the second. And Freudy walks into the room, and the amplifiers saturate. I mean, it completely went off the scale. And I said to Freudy, Freudy, sit down. You're making a huge signal. Of course, I sort of talked to dogs like I talked to people.
Right.
I don't know what he understood. I mean, he understood sit, obviously. So there he sat down, and his tail was wagging. And as his tail was wagging back and forth, I saw the signal on the computer screen. I was serving as an antenna.
That's where we'll have to leave it for there, but I'll come right back and pick it up right there with Dr. Gary Schwartz on Coast to Coast AM. And so far, it's kind of an all 80s weekend, as Curis just pointed out, on Coast to Coast AM. Kind of a coincidence. But you know what? As we're continuing to sort of poke at this subject of healing energy. You never know what's going to come up between now and the end of the show. I want to get back to the transplant stories, and we just heard about the tail wagging of the dog as it was being picked up by the equipment being used by Dr. Gary Schwartz. We'll talk about that in just a moment. I wanted to let you know that during the break, I finally was able to get my blog linked at coasttocoastam.com. So if you go to coasttocoastam.com, go to the lower left-hand corner, you'll see a tab there that'll take you to the blog. If you missed crypto news tonight, you can pick it up right there. A couple of interesting stories all pertaining to exactly what's going on outside in the real world. Or is it more of an unreal world, a world that we too often take for granted, that we think that just because we can't see something that it doesn't really exist? These energy fields, which, come on, we hear about all the time, and people wearing scarves and, you know, at state fairs and all this other stuff. Can you really trust it? Can you really believe it? Well, I think you can really believe Dr. Gary Schwartz, University of Arizona professor, as he continues his research into that and where it'll take us into the future, too. Coming up on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so you were talking about doing this experiment with a former colleague in which you were measuring energy fields that were going back and forth between you when her dog, Freudy, came in and wagging Freudy's tail. What did you see, Dr. Schwartz?
Well, literally, the wagging of his tail, just like the movement of our hands, and this was over 10 feet distance, the wagging of his tail was actually being shown as a wave on the computer that was being received by my body and then being transmitted by my body to the electrode box and then to the computer. Now, why that was important to me personally was that, you know, we hear all kinds of stories about how the presence of animals, for example, can have healing effects on people. There's all these stories about that we receive comfort and love and so on.
Sure.
We don't typically entertain the idea that literally when a dog, for example, shows us joy and, so to speak, wags every cell in its body, that what it's actually doing is generating a massive, by biological standards, electromagnetic field that we're being bathed in. And this field is actually providing us with a signal that is helping us to equilibrate our bodies, to become coherent around that signal. And so for me, it was just an instance of an experience, you know, where I was actually picking up not just anyone's hand movements or whatever, but literally every animal. I mean, I talk about, for example, in the book how, you know, we see a bird flying even near us, and it's fluttering its wings, and we think we're separated from that bird. But that bird's flapping of its feathers is actually generating an electromagnetic field that we are picking up. And we, in turn, when we move, we're generating a signal. Even our breathing generates a signal that's going back to the bird.
You know,
the take-home message here is that we're all connected by these invisible electromagnetic fields, and that's the first step in the logical train of being able to establish that we can affect one another energetically.
See, and I always thought it was the medicinal effect of dog slobber. And I'm not kidding. I mean, I think that there's something about, you know, the idea of when a dog or a puppy, I mean, you look at you say it's kind of a breakthrough idea. It certainly is, until you consider Charlie Brown's classic poster, Happiness is a Warm Puppy.
Absolutely. You know, all this is doing is providing a scientific way of measuring these effects and taking
right.
it one step further. By the way, someday somebody should do the dog slobber experiments.
Oh, they should. And you know what? I'll even throw you one a little bit more. I would love to have seen what the results would have been had you had your eyes closed while the dog was wagging his tail.
Well, I did that. I closed my eyes as well.
Did
as
you?
Opened it. Yes, it makes no difference.
It made no difference because I would think, again, then that excludes the idea that visually seeing the – well, visually seeing, there's a – but I just mean if you see a dog wag its tail that you are, it makes you happy and therefore it gave you a different result.
Right.
Okay. Very cool. Well, but see, now let me ask you about the difference then between – good energy and bad energy. Let's say that it had been a dog there, an angry dog that was not wagging his tail and was instead just standing there growling.
Yes, or an angry person.
Or an angry person.
Right. Well, since you mentioned the E. coli experiments, let's mention that briefly because there's a perfect example where the energy of the healer is unknowingly affecting whether or not cells live or die in an experiment where they're actually trying to produce healing. Shall we talk about that?
Yeah, I think it's a great example of that because I think this is where, again, it comes down to even just going to visit your neighborhood-friendly general practitioner, you can end up not being as you can come out of a doctor's office feeling worse depending on what mood they're in, and they're just treating you with, you know, pills or potions of some sort.
Exactly, and that this may be mediated not just psychologically but energetically. So here's the experiment. My colleagues and I were doing research to see whether or not Reiki, which is a particular form of energy healing that comes out of Japan, whether Reiki could affect E. coli bacteria in test tubes, which had been exposed to heat stress, which actually we titrated it so that 50% of the cells were killed by the particular temperature of heat. And then we were looking to see to what extent they were growing back and reaching their normal colony level of population of cells, of bacteria. And there were a group of test tubes that the healers were treating. Of course, they never touched them. They were actually put in a container, so they couldn't actually physically touch the bacteria, obviously. And there was a control. There were a set of test tubes in another part of the laboratory that were untreated. And after the Reiki practitioners would treat the bacteria, the cells were then prepared to be...
Well, but how did they treat the bacteria? What did they do? What did the Reiki practitioners do to the tube with the E. coli that had been heated? What did they do to it?
Well, what they did was for 15 minutes, they would sit in front of the tubes, and they would, quote, run Reiki energy. They would, quote, with their consciousness, send Reiki energy to these tubes, in the case of Reiki, for, quote, the best and highest good for the cells, which was presumed to allow them to recover. And so they were attempting to, heal these injured bacteria. And they would do the same thing as they did with a person. Now, this was a blind experiment because after the test tubes were collected, they were then scored blindly, meaning the person who was actually doing the assays did not know which were the treated and which were the controls. And each practitioner was brought in for multiple days, okay? Now, the prediction was that Reiki would, on the average, actually increase the rate of cell growth, i.e. the population would recover. And what we discovered was that this happened some of the time, but sometimes the cells went in the reverse direction. They were actually doing worse. They were, quote, dying. And the question is, why was that happening? Now, one of the things that I did was I requested that each time a healer would enter the laboratory, they would fill out a simple questionnaire where they would rate their physical and emotional and spiritual well-being on what we call the Arizona Integrative Outcome Scale, simple 0 to 10 scale. And of course, some practitioners on some days came into the laboratory relaxed, happy, grounded, well, and so on. But other days, and other practitioners, they'd come in, they were stressed, or they were depressed, or they were physically tired, or they weren't feeling well, or they had a fight with their child, or with their boyfriend or girlfriend, or whomever. And the question was, to what extent did the emotional state and sense of well-being of the healer influence how successful they were in providing Reiki for healing? And what we discovered, to my amazement, was that if they came into the lab feeling well, reporting themselves well and relaxed and so on, the bacteria showed a positive result. But if they came into the lab feeling stressed, having negative emotions, the bacteria actually did worse. They were actually, quote, dying. Now, what's interesting about this is that Reiki practitioners like to believe that their emotional state doesn't matter, that all that matters is their intention. So if they come in and they're working with someone and they just send this healing energy, that their emotional state isn't going to affect this. But these cells were actually picking this up. And remember, the cells in this case, they don't know Reiki from Shmeiki. You know,
right.
They don't have any belief system here. In fact, they couldn't even see the practitioner because they were in an enclosed container. So the...
Well, that and they don't have eyes.
And they don't have, something. They don't have what we call eyes, certainly.
Right.
But they can pick up the electromagnetic signals.
Right.
That's what's important.
And that was so. What we get from that is that bad energy kills, and good energy can create life. And that's one small experiment that seems to affirm that basic principle.
Yes, and what's interesting is it wasn't designed to find that. That's just how the data actually came out. And of course, you don't want to generalize and therefore say, well, gee, if my doctor's in a bad mood, you know, I'm going to have a heart attack as opposed to have a cardiac recovery. It's not, you know, that simple. But on the other hand, what we can wonder about, and we should talk about this later, about what happens when we do long-distance collective studies where you have hundreds or thousands of people sending an intention that where the intention is combined. Under what circumstances can you have powerful, not just positive effects, but negative effects? And we have to be open to that. I mean, the truth is, energy is like a surgeon's knife. That knife can be used either for curing or killing. So the energy itself is not, quote, necessarily, quote, good or bad per se, but rather how it's used, and of course the frequencies that are therefore imposed on that energy, and can be either healing or destroying.
Well, see, I don't know that I mean, here I am telling you, you're professor of everything except math at Arizona. But, I mean, how can you say that it's not the energy per se? When in the end, I think it seems very clear, because we can just sort of feel this intuitively. You can be standing next to somebody who's having a bad day,
right,
and you can feel that energy from them, and it doesn't feel good.
No, let me, you're absolutely right. Let's clarify this. When I say it's not the energy per se, the term energy here is being used fairly loosely.
Okay.
Because there's the word energy, which is in physics, is defined as the capacity to do work and overcome resistance.
Okay.
Which is a very vague general definition.
Sure is.
Okay, and then there is information, which is frequency or pattern, which is carried on the energy. So, for example, the reason why you can hear me and I can hear you is because the carrier wave that is actually quite a high frequency, much higher than our voice, that wave is then being modulated by the frequencies of our voice, right?
Right.
And so what matters in this case, if I tell you I love you or I hate you, those two different words have very different effects on people, not because of, quote, the energy per se, but it's the information that's riding on the energy.
Okay.
When I say that what we mean by negative energy is negative information that's riding on the energy.
Okay.
So that's just a linguistic, but it's an important one here.
Right. And I wonder how because you said about the information, and I wonder whether you could do an experiment on that by having somebody speak to you in a foreign language that you don't understand, and with the nicest, sweetest voice and all of the lovely physical characteristics tell you that they hate you.
Absolutely, and vice versa. And by the way,
yeah,
I've actually done some research that's related to this. This was actually more than 15 years ago when I was a professor at Yale in the area of what's called repression. And what happens is there's a disconnect between what a person says and the way that they say it. So if you ask someone, are you angry? And the person
right.
says, I'm not angry.
Right.
Well, the words are saying one thing, but the tone of voice is saying something else. And in this case, they're not aware of their tone of voice.
Right.
Now, what's interesting about this is imagine for the moment that you can't even hear the person. Imagine that you're in another room, for example, and this person is now saying to you, but you're not allowed to hear or see, but the person is you know, describing the thing, you know, I'm not mad at that person.
Right.
Again, even though you're not even there, you can't hear it, you can't see it, will you actually pick up the negative intention of the underlying, you know, tone of voice and so on, which you can't hear? And what our research suggests is yes, because that's the same thing as the, so to speak, as the what the E. coli bacteria were responding to.
Well, and the E. coli bacteria experiment was most interesting to me when we considered that we all have E. coli in us.
Yes.
Every day, and that it's the right balance of E. coli in our systems, which is essential for digestion and for measuring whether or not the restaurant's any good. And right, it's our own God's natural rating system. And so, if we have this, I mean, and we're in balance, we have this sort of symbiotic relationship with the E. coli that's in our system,
right.
And so that brings us to the idea of this the cellular memory to me, in a way, of the things that your body does or things that your body systems maintain that you're not even aware of, and the possibility of energy being disconnected from your body and still continuing to emanate your own aura. I mean, is that too kooky to say it like that?
No, but I'd like you to take it one step further and tell me what the implication you're leading to.
Well, I want to get to the transplant thing here coming up in a minute. But I also want to even just get to the subject of, and people have talked about this, the idea of ghost limbs, right? When they've lost, say, a leg or even a finger, and they still feel that finger.
Yes.
And I mean, that to me is sort of follows right along this line.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that's very interesting is that, you know, what they call phantom limbs or, you know,
right,
limbs, is the way neurology typically attempts to explain this is that your sensory cortex still has a memory for the limb, even though it's not there. And so what's happening is you're simply having an illusion. It's an hallucination that your limb is no longer present. What they don't entertain is the possibility that literally the energy and information of the limb is still present. And there's actually been some research published where they did some research where they attempted to test whether or not a person could tell, a person who had an amputated arm, for example, if they were blindfolded, and then an experimenter put his or her hand near the amputated limb,
right,
versus not near the limb. Could they tell? Could the limb that wasn't there, still having all this energy and sensitivity, the quote aura or the field, and we'll talk about that later if you like when we talk about the
transplant
aura research that I've done.
Right. I can't wait to talk about that.
Yeah, which we've actually measured these kinds of things. That they could actually tell whether somebody was near their phantom limb or not, which is now telling us that somehow they are registering. Their limb is registering the presence of the energy. That's what the implication is.
Because your cerebral cortex can't have a memory of somebody else's hand near your stump.
Absolutely not.
Right. So that would make sense up to that point. And then I would love. Well, we'll get into this. We'll take this where it'll go. Coming up in just a minute with Dr. Gary Schwartz. Again, we're talking about his book about the healing energy experiments that he's been involved with, and the results, and the very fascinating results. I too want to get into the discussion of people who have been contacted from the dead. I have had some experiences with that. I'd love to run by you and. But more specifically about the transplants. Is it possible that transplant recipients will change their characteristics, their personality? Can they see different changes in their own body because of the person that was a donor for their organ or such? Next on Coast to Coast AM. The book is The Energy Healing Experiments, Dr. Gary Schwartz from the University of Arizona. Where he teaches everything except PE. So let's go back to this thing about the energy at a cellular level of the body. That is, where what is the seat of the soul, if you will, on this? What, from where does the energy emanate? Do we know?
Well, interestingly, if we take into account what quantum physics tells us,
okay,
and then we combine that with what systems theory tells us, we are led to the conclusion that energy operates at every level, from the subatomic particle and even the virtual particles like photons, all the way through complex molecules like DNA, through the whole of the cell itself, through complete organ systems like a heart or a brain, through the body and beyond. And so therefore, it's not like the energy begins at the cellular level or at the DNA level, but actually the energy and information pervades all of it. You know, you've heard the term, it's turtles all the way down. It's energy all the way down.
Okay.
And therefore, the essence of who we are is almost, if you would, holographic, because it's actually organized at all these different levels. And although it's really hard to sort of comprehend all of this or to make sense of all of this because it's so outrageously complex, the truth is that's the way it really is.
All right, so let's just say then it's like cloning, that you could take one cell and there's enough imprinted information in one cell of what the whole thing is supposed to look like. The whole blueprint is in that one cell that you could theoretically replicate the entire based on the partial.
Exactly. In fact, and that the components of the cell will have this too. So although this is very controversial, the whole of the cell is not just simply in the DNA, but it's literally in the structure of the water which comprises the cell, which is 70 to 80% of the cell.
Now, that makes sense for physiology. That makes sense for the amount of hair that will grow on a man's back, or, you know, the color and, you know, direction of their toenails or something.
Right.
But that doesn't explain what seems to be happening with some of these transplant cases, and I think this is a good way to get into that, because we are talking about energy of a different sort when you take something that had been in one body and you transplant it into another.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes and no. And let me suggest that we think about this. And that is, we know, for example, that our brains are involved with our emotions and involved with our thoughts. I say involved with our emotions and our thoughts because I don't want us to come to the conclusion that the brain is creating our thoughts and emotions. In fact, we can talk about this later, but it's more like an antenna receiver for consciousness than it is actually a creator of consciousness. But if we therefore assume that everything that we're even conscious of, all of our personal history, is somehow involved with the energy and information of our anatomy and physiology, including our consciousness, then that energy and information is going to be literally stored also within every cell. And so, therefore, we can come to the prediction that that it's not just the, quote, brain that learns, but literally the storage of information and energy is occurring throughout the body. And therefore, an organ like the heart is a very brilliant system for retaining some of the essence of who we are.
Okay. First of all, I made a similar argument once to Matthew Alper, the guy who wrote The God Part of the Brain.
Mm-hmm.
Because I said, well, what if the God part of the brain, he was talking about it as being a transmitter and that, you know, you could accentuate it and you could get a feeling of divine euphoria, et cetera. And I said, well, what if it's not that? What if it's a receiver? And some people just don't have it. And some people, you know, they don't have that part of their brain, doesn't pick up the vibrations of the divine.
Right. And or it's been turned off for a set of reasons. They have it.
Right.
It's been suppressed.
Yeah, he didn't like that argument.
I bet he didn't. But he also probably wouldn't like our research on life after death either.
He probably wouldn't like that either. All right, but sorry. So, but again, I think this is where it really gets really intriguing, though, because you're talking about, say, let's say the heart transplant. You're going to transplant a heart into somebody.
Right.
Okay, that heart is comprised of cells from the original body, but that heart, we think of it as being very, it's muscle tissue.
Exactly.
and it's some fat and it's some other things, and we transplant that into another person, and that when it's in the other person, it goes back to its primary function, which was to, you know, process blood, oxygenate blood throughout the body.
Definitely.
That's its primary function. We don't think of it as having a software program loaded into it that contains that carries over information from the donor.
That's correct. But that's because we don't really think about it very clearly. In a previous book that I wrote called The Living Energy Universe, I actually describe how the reason why, for example, the brain, quote, learns is because the brain neurons have what are called feedback loops. We call it a neural network. And what's interesting about this is that in order for a network to learn, the output of the network must feed back to the input of the network. And by the way, if you connect the feedback loop from the output to the input, the network will not learn. Now, what's interesting is that we can model that in a computer. That's where artificial intelligence comes in. And we have what's called neural network software. But there are no neurons in the brain. There are just these feedback loops and so on. And again, if you cut those loops, they don't learn. And so here's the big take-home message. Do neurons learn because they're neurons, or do they learn because their architecture is that they're created as a network with feedback loops? And it's a no-brainer, pun intended, meaning that the reason why the computer can learn the same way that the neurons learn is because what does the learning are the feedback loops in a network. Now, all organ systems are actually comprised of feedback networks, because that's how systems work. All systems have feedback. Therefore, if feedback is what's actually involved with learning, then the heart's going to learn just like the brain's going to learn. It's not going to learn maybe as, quote, as well, because it doesn't have as many feedback loops, but it's still got billions and billions of cells which are orchestrated. And therefore, simple logic takes you to the conclusion that the heart, which is in the center of the body that's receiving all these electrical and signals streaming through it from all the different organs, is going to integrate and orchestrate a significant subset of the essence of who we are.
Okay, but aren't there differences between the cells that comprise our brain matter and the cells that comprise our heart matter?
They are different, but what they share in common is that they're organized with complex feedback loops. And it's the feedback that allows the learning to take place. Now, that's the big take-home message.
I imagine a guitar player standing in front of an amp,
yes,
who hits a note, who then the note feeds back on itself, that feeds back on itself, that feeds back on itself, and that one note, that one strum of the guitar then becomes this sort of ongoing feedback loop, right?
Exactly.
Is that sort of
reverberating circuit? By the way, were you a guitarist?
Not a good one.
But
that would be about my level of performance. If you liked that would be, I'd be great.
Because I was a guitarist.
Okay.
And I even played professionally for a while. I was not great, really? But I played, you know, they paid me for some ridiculous reason.
Do you teach music in Arizona, too?
No,
do you do that?
I don't. I'm doing research now on music and sound as a healing energy, but that's another story.
Anyway, well, I want to go back to the guitar loop, because I think, is that...
You know, I want to stay with the guitar. Because the take-home message is what goes around and stays around evolves around. And with the guitar or with a microphone, where it works the same way, when you connect that feedback loop, and we call it feedback, there's an echo. The system literally continues to remember that which was originally created.
And is that autism?
Autism? No.
No. Stay with me on that.
Yeah,
that kind of like autism, where the feedback loop is going on, and that somebody repeats something over and over again, and they just kind of become fixed on something more?
Well, I think autism could be described as when that system goes out of control.
Right.
But that's a different story from saying that the normal process of learning involves feedback loops. By the way, that's how the brain learns, feedback loops. And feedback exists at every system at every level. So getting back to your main point here, you know, when an organ is transplanted, let's say their heart or heart and lungs, for example, you know, people have to take these immunosuppressant drugs because the body attempts to reject it. Now, here's what medicine typically assumes. They assume that what the body is doing is treating the DNA and of the new cells as foreign to the recipient's DNA, and so it's, quote, rejecting it. But what they don't entertain is the possibility that the body's not simply rejecting the anatomy or the biochemistry, but it's attempting to reject the energy and information that's stored within the cells. And that's where the psychology of cardiac transplant patients becomes really important, because the prediction would be, therefore, if people could learn to accept and embrace their hearts psychologically and energetically, they might actually be a reduced need for antisuppressant medication. because they're actually then allowing the integration of the energy and information of the heart with the rest of their body.
Is it like having two software programs running simultaneously?
Exactly. So if you would, it's like two networks. And I talk about cellular network systems within in the Energy Healing Experiments book. And it's sort of like, how does Verizon get to talk to Sprint? Well, they have to be coordinated and integrated so that instead of being in competition, they actually can communicate effectively.
Yeah, but I mean, if you had two operating platforms built onto your hard drive,
right?
And so every time you booted up, your computer was having to choose between which one of the operating platforms. Would that not explain why the push and pull of a heart going into a new body, if it has DNA and cellular memory,
right?
It's trying to also transmit information into the body, not just be a functioning, you know, throbbing muscle.
It's a beautiful metaphor. By the way, it's delightful to talk to somebody who thinks about these issues so deeply. Thank you for that.
Well, and you know what? And thank you for writing a book that allows you to think about stuff like that without having to get stoned. I mean, these are the kind of stuff I would sit around and have conversations with friends in high school. This would be the kind of stuff they'd be talking about, but they were totally high. So this is I almost want to go back in time now and sit there, and I could finally converse with them. I know what the heck they were talking about.
You know what's really interesting, by the way? This book provides scientific validation for a lot of things that we could get stoned about. And it's nice to be able, and it's a privilege to be able to do research that actually reveals that there's a reality to all of this, that we shouldn't be throwing stones. We should be celebrating what the universe is revealing to us.
Well, and so that brings us to this idea somehow that the person, the recipient, could be changed by the personality traits or the characteristics or some of the other more ethereal aspects of the donor information that's in the heart.
Absolutely. And what's interesting also, you know, you talked about your idea about how if the brain is a receiver, then
right.
A receiver of information, then if part of the receiver is missing or is just turned off or the volume is turned down, it's not going to pick up the signal. One of the things that people often ask me about when we talk about the heart transplant research that I was involved with, how is it that only a small percentage of patients actually report personality changes that end up matching those of the donor? And I explained to people that a lot of people, their brains are literally turned off. They're literally repressing. They're shutting down awareness out of fear, out of lack of understanding, also some of the drugs they take. And so consequently, many people are not actually going to allow those signals to reach their consciousness.
Now, so let's go into how can you do an experiment that would show that the recipient of a transplant had changed their characteristics, their distinct personality patterns, to be more accommodating to the donor.
Okay. Well, first of all, we have to define that these experiments are being done, quote, as a side effect of transplant surgery. It's not like we're doing an experiment where we're taking dogs' hearts, you know, one set of dogs that, let's say, were trained to be loving and another set of dogs that were trained to be fighters, and then transplanting the dog's heart into donor hearts and looking to see whether the personality of the dogs changed. And by the way, that could be done. No one's done that study yet.
Well, that could end up being the defense for Michael Vick before it's over. So.
Right.
He's doing some sort of scientific experiments. But so
well,
they've tried everything else so far.
Books here. But getting back to your question, what happens is that in order to do research in this area, what you need to do is you need to be able to track patients who have had transplants, where after their transplants they've discovered changes in their personality which are bizarre to them because they're unexpected to them, and then independently verify that that the characteristics of the donor actually predate and predict the personality changes that take place in the recipient. And by the way, there have been, to the best of my knowledge, no, quote, formal experiments that have done this. Instead, what's happened is that people have collected systematically a series of case studies which document that this effect occurs and the challenge has been actually to raise the research money to be able to do a formal experiment of this. But I had the privilege of working with Paul Pearsall, who wrote a book called The Heart's Code, and we published 10 cases of cardiac transplants where not only was the personality change of the donor able to be verified, but there were at least two members of the donor's family that could actually verify that the donor personality matched that of the patient. So you had verification on both sides. And some of these stories are just, they're very dramatic and they're very heart-wrenching.
Give us an example of that.
Sure. I'll give you two of my favorites. In one case, there was a man who worked in a factory who needed a heart transplant, and he received the transplant of a young black man. And he was, he had the standard stereotypes of, for example, African Americans tend to like rap music. And he didn't want to start wanting to like rap music. It's very amusing. But what happened was he developed a passion for classical music. I mean, he started paying attention to classical music. He started singing melodies of classical music. It drove his wife a little crazy. She couldn't understand it. They later ended up meeting the mother of the young man who was killed, and they discovered that this young man had just left his violin lessons. He was a classical violinist, and he was struck by a car and killed. And so here was a case where a man had a personality change that was directly related to a fundamental preference of the heart of the young man that he had within him, and where it was a completely different from what his, quote, fears were. That's one case. A second case, and this is just very precious, was reported to Paul Pearsall by a psychiatrist, and I suspect that this is a credible account. There was this young child, a girl, who received a heart of a girl who had been murdered.
All right. You know, I'm going to, because the story, the way it's going, I just don't want to rush you through it, so I'm going to ask you to hold on that.
Sure.
We'll just do it coming up just a minute. We'll pick it up right there. A girl who receives the heart of another girl who had been murdered. And when we go to the phones coming up next hour, let's go ahead and put that on the table then, Dr. Schwartz. We'll just say, if you've ever been the recipient of a transplant, have you noted, what did you notice about the way you changed afterward? And I'd be curious, because do you just change just because you got a second lease on life?
Mm-hmm.
Because you feel like you feel a sense of gratitude, ebullience that you have achieved, another milestone that you never thought you'd ever have? I don't know. We'll come back to that. And we'll get the rest of the comments, too, coming up for Dr. Gary Schwartz with Ian Punnett on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Gary Schwartz, Dr. Gary Schwartz. The Energy Healing Experiments is the book, and it's just fascinating. We'll get back to that story about the donor, a girl, whose personality changed after receiving the heart from another girl, and we'll get into some of the other stories that are in the book. It's amazing work he's been doing, and then I'll also just remind you, too, if you hook up to it at coasttocoastam.com, you can find out more about my blog for tonight. And thank you, the people who have emailed in already on that. It's just some crypto news from earlier in the night, but you can find that, my IP Freely blog, at coasttocoastam.com. Your calls coming up after the top of the hour, and we'll be looking for people who have had a transplant to see whether or not you noticed anything change about you that you can't account for. Could it have been something about the donor? Maybe you knew the donor. Maybe you found out about the donor later on. We'll use that anecdotally as the conversation continues on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So Dr. Gary Schwartz was just getting into story number two, an example of a girl that had undergone a personality shift after receiving an organ from another girl that had been murdered. Dr. Schwartz, if you could just pick that up, that'd be great.
Yes, this little girl received the heart of another girl who had been murdered, and she began having nightmares. And in her dreams, she was actually seeing the details of a little girl being murdered. And her mother was very upset. Her mother didn't know whether or not her daughter was going crazy, whether this was a side effect of the medication, whether there's something with the transplant, could she have possibly been connecting with the little girl who died. Anyway, she brought her daughter to a psychiatrist, and the psychiatrist evaluated this little girl, child psychiatrist, and came to the conclusion that this girl didn't seem crazy. She seemed to be having information, and some of this information was verifiable by the police. So she then took the daughter and the mother to the police, and it turned out that details of the daughter's dream not only matched what the police knew, but more importantly, there were other details that allowed them to then ultimately arrest and bring to justice the person who had murdered the little girl who died.
That sounds like such an urban legend.
I know it sounds like an urban legend. And normally, you know, we would dismiss such a thing out of hand. However, when first of all, there's scientific reasoning that would predict that such a thing should be able to happen in the first place. And secondly, the account is being given by a credible psychiatrist. These are quote extraordinary accounts to the extent that they can be verified scientifically. We need to listen to them.
Well, I'm good with that, but I mean, you'll pardon me for a cheap analogy here, but there's scientific reasoning that says the 35W bridge should still be up.
Yes, just because there's reasoning doesn't mean that it's correct.
Right.
So what's the bottom line? The bottom line is the proof is in the pudding. That's why for me, that's why it's called the energy healing experiments. You know, there are all kinds of, quote, theories, but the theories ultimately don't matter. What matters is what turns out to be true, i.e. what can be demonstrated under controlled conditions. And that's where the formal experiments in this book become so important, because it allows us to determine which of our, you know, our stories, our beliefs are true, and which of them are not.
And so let's continue to pursue this a little bit. And to its, where do we go with its logical end? When we're talking about donors, should we then be thinking about the compatibility of a donor at a much more at a psychological level as well as a physiological one, or it's not just a matter of blood type and the size of the heart and the chest cavity, et cetera, but what kind of life one person led, the donor led, before we would allow them to have that heart, you know, implanted into another person's body?
In theory, although it's very, you know, painful and complicated, the ethical question is, of course. I mean, if it turns out that there are, pathology or problems in the life of the potential donor, the recipient should at least be aware of that possibility and then be able to make a choice. Of course, in heart transplants, this is also extraordinarily difficult because things have to be done in a very quick time frame.
Sure.
But the fact of the matter is that in principle, we need to entertain this, and it should be part of informed consent. It's the same thing if we discover, for example, that the emotional state of a healer, that his or her energy is, you know, going to potentially affect our cellular health and well-being. Or
right.
Imagine, for example, that all of this is true, and that then the science is supporting this. And I mean science as in experiments are supporting this. And now you talk about hospitals, which, as you know, you've got very stressed doctors and very stressed workers working under long hours and so on. They're working under conditions where they're no longer feeling either supported or that they're able to do their jobs the way they feel they should be done properly because of the HMOs and having to do things in a very quick time frame.
Right.
You've also got environments of hospitals which are electromagnetically polluted. So you've not only got the energy of the medical staff and the nursing staff as being stressed, but you've also got all these, you know, if you would, unfriendly environmental conditions. That makes a hospital potentially a dangerous place to be in from an energetic point of view. And we have to entertain these possibilities and address them, even though they may be difficult or economically challenging or ethically, require that we make adjustments.
There's a small hospital outside of the Twin Cities that puts a big emphasis on the feng shui layout of every room, every hallway, that they have all sorts of healing art and sculpture that's done in the hallways, and that everything that is put in a room has to be passed through a board of art I guess, judges of some sort mm-hmm. who look at everything for their healing potential and whether the image is, you know, encourages enough in the way of a spiritual or physical, I guess, maybe even regrowth. But then they also have other things like a labyrinth in the garden, and every room faces rose bushes or flowers, and every room's on the first floor. They don't have any second story rooms. I mean, it's very interesting how they went to all of this trouble to try to be on the cutting edge of this type of healing medicine.
Yes, and also by creating such an environment for their patients, they're also creating such an environment for their staff. You know, what kind of environment would you feel more comfortable working in? One that's beautiful, where there's healing music, where there's healing art, where you yourself want to go to work because it's so comforting? Or would you prefer to be in an environment where the colors clash and and there's all this noise and so on and so forth? I mean, it's sort of obvious that it's that for many, many reasons, this is a wise thing to do.
Or industrial gray-green tile and all that other stuff. There's been. But I'll go back to the heart thing and the idea of somebody that's up to be a donor. Should we, to follow what you said, should we tell the potential recipient of this heart transplant, look, just want to let you know this was not a person who lived a good life. They have a very healthy heart, but that's mostly because they were very selfish. They didn't care about anybody else but themselves, which was good because it means they walked several miles a day or whatever, and they were known by their friends as being black-hearted. They didn't give to charity. There was nobody there at their funeral. However we describe that, and leave that up to the recipient to decide whether or not that's the kind of heart that he wants in him or her.
Well, you know what? Again, in the abstract, we could say yes. In the concrete, of course, the average patient who's waiting for a heart may or may not be in either psychological or physiological state to even process that information. So then you'd have to say, well, that decision should also be potentially made by the family.
Right.
And if you have a choice between, you know, living or dying, or taking the heart of someone whose life you don't necessarily admire, you still might obviously choose to take the risk in order to be able to continue physically on the planet. These are very difficult, you know, ethical questions, but they are real, and they need to be considered. Now, of course, being a scientist, what I have to say is that the stories that we've collected, even albeit as controlled as they are, they really need to be replicated under large controlled experiments in order to be able to draw any firm conclusions. And the challenge is for science to be able to address these questions, even though they're controversial, and even though the implications, you know, would require that we change the way we do things and the way we think about things. But
ten
that's
years,
part of the excitement of science.
10 years after somebody has had a transplant, if you went back in with a scalpel and took off part of their transplanted heart, for example, the heart that had been implanted into them, if you took that sample from the donor heart, would it still have the donor heart's DNA?
Well, it would certainly have the donor's heart DNA if you took the heart back out. The question is, how much of the heart would now have incorporated the information of the recipient? And by the way, how much of the recipient's DNA information would now be, the donor's information would now be observed by the recipient? So if you can imagine taking the donor's heart out now and replacing it with somebody else's heart, would the personality changes persist?
Right.
And I think that part depends upon how long the heart has been in the brain and in the body in total, and also to what extent that information has been, you know, if you would digest it and integrate it into the total memory system of the recipient. You know, it's interesting, Ian. You actually brought up the question about even life after death, the whole idea of that our consciousness continues after we physically die, and how does that relate to the energy healing experiments? And I was curious, why is it that did you bring up that particular topic?
Well, I've always been interested in it, and I have when I was reading particularly the section in your book in which you offered your reflections on some people like John Edwards, and I have had some contact both through this show and through others with those that profess to be able to speak for the dead, mm-hmm. I find myself in the position of wanting to believe them, but actually in my own personal experience, being disconfirmed that they're able to do anything from just things that some of the most famous of them have said to me, things they've said to me, which were totally 100% wrong, and they were claiming that they were able to do this in some sort of verifiable, observable manner.
Right. Well, let's address two aspects of this. First of all, you could say, well, why did I include such work in the Energy Healing Experiments book?
Right.
And part of the reason was because we had actually included questions about people's experience of life after death as an evaluation of individual differences in people's both sensitivity to detecting the energy of others and also in actually recovery from heart disease. And I was initially shocked to find that if people, for example, reported having experienced a communication from someone who had died, what's called an after-death communication, which they had personally experienced. And, of course, we don't know whether that was, quote, a real experience or an imagined one. But if they reported having it, not only were they more accurate in being able to detect the energy and intention in a controlled experiment, but they were also more likely to recover more effectively from heart surgery. And that becomes extraordinarily interesting because it suggests that there may be not only some reality to the after-death communications if it relates to energy detection, but also that it may actually have some health consequences. And by the way, healers often report that part of what they do is that they receive, quote, intuition or guidance from a larger spiritual reality so that the healing is not just their own personal energy, but they, quote, they're receiving, quote, assistance from above.
But I think there's a difference between intuition and guidance from above. And I'm good with the guidance from above in another context. I don't want to confuse the two.
Right.
Because when people say from above, I'm not looking for angel guides who are going to come in and they're standing on my shoulders and whatever, and they're going to tell this person something. To me, there's something really cool about intuition. And I think I'm more intuitive than some people I know, and I know that there are other people considerably more intuitive than I am. But still, intuition, it seems to me, to be have its own kind of gestalt.
Absolutely. I completely agree with you. The question is, I'm just recounting what healers claim.
Right.
Healers claim that part of the source of their intuition is coming from, for example, people who have died.
Right.
Now, that's their claim. I'm not saying whether their claim is true or not. I'm saying that's what they claim. And what happens if science could actually address that question? And if you'd like, we could have another whole show on this. We could talk about research about how do you address whether or not certain mediums are real or not.
Yeah, I'd love that.
How do you bring that into the laboratory?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and for that matter, too, how many of them are unwilling to go into a laboratory because I think they suspect that there are more limitations than...
Exactly.
Are in their press release. I mean, I will tell you, just for the sake of argument, I sat with one of the best known mediums on the planet, and if I didn't give him anything.
Good.
He wanted to. He was fishing for it. I'm getting a name. Begins with A. Alvin. It was such a carny act to me. And I wanted to think that he could just, if there was a mechanism by which he could do that, then he could just look at me and he could say, by the way, your dad says, and he could say something that would be phenomenal.
Right.
But instead, he was, if I hadn't said anything, he had nothing to work with.
Well, first of all, you know, for some mediums, they're really lousy.
Right.
And they do fish. And they engage in what's called cold reading. Okay?
Right.
However, we've done experiments where the medium never sees the sitter, never hears from the sitter.
That's fascinating.
No communication with the sitter.
That's fascinating.
And even where the experimenter doesn't know details about the sitter or the deceased, what's called a proxy sitter. So that rules out all of this kind of fishing expedition and any kind of searching or getting feedback. And the really, quote, superstars, I call them Michael Jordans of the mediumship world, they end up being able to still get accurate information, way above chance. which you can't explain by any of these conventional mechanisms. Now, I want to just briefly mention about the Michael Jordan phenomena, because do you know what Michael Jordan's average percentage of getting his shots in from the floor were?
Probably 33%.
I think it was closer to 45 or 48, okay. but it was still less than 50%. Okay,
right. Even the best shooters have lower percentages than you think.
Right, and also they typically have air balls.
Right,
and they also make fouls, and some days they have terrible days. But we don't, therefore, because Michael Jordan fouls, or because he has air balls, or because he has an off game, therefore come to the conclusion that Michael Jordan's a fraud, or he can't play basketball. So what we have to do is to be very careful to not overgeneralize from a few bad shots, or a few fouls, or an off day, and therefore draw a conclusion that this is impossible or unreal. What you have to do is you have to collect a lot of data under controlled conditions, and then see what the real statistics are.
Well, okay, I'll go with you on this, but here's the difference to me, to extend your metaphor about mediums and Michael Jordan a little bit further. Michael Jordan didn't build a reputation on other people taking his shots for him. And I think that's the difference, is that that's where too often these mediums rely on other people to give them the information, which then they take credit for.
Absolutely. Okay.
And that's the part that really, and you can see it in these TV shows, and I know these guys are super popular, but it clearly, you know, when they throw out a question going, I'm getting a message from a Betty. Does somebody, does the name Betty mean anything? And somebody stands up and says, I know a Betty. And it's like, okay, well, you just took the shot for him from half court.
Yeah,
and he's
way,
standing there parading around like he got something.
Yeah, when I started doing research in this area, I actually took courses in how to be a fake medium. So I know what the tricks are.
Okay.
I also know how to distinguish the fakes from the real ones.
Well, that is another conversation that I would love to have with
Let's
you.
Let's have it someday.
Okay, very good. Gary Schwartz, Dr. Gary Schwartz's book, The Energy Healing Experiments. All right, coming up then, we'll give you all the numbers so that you can join the conversation too. We'll be looking for people who are donor recipients and whether or not you've made any changes. Anything you could feel was something that you didn't have any control over. You just did become different after you got your transplant. And we'll talk a little bit about the future of the energy healing experiments as well. Where is this taking us? We'll find out next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. The energy healing experiments by Dr. Gary Schwartz. The subtitle of the book is Science Reveals Our Natural Power to Heal. We didn't really talk about sex, but I will throw that out there because in reading through the book, I didn't come across a section on that. But do you have any reflection on that healing aspect of energy when it comes to romance?
Absolutely. As you know, we did talk about love and the relationship of love to the receiving, particularly of heart energy, between one person and another.
Right.
In this case, the perception of parental love, and also long-term physical and emotional health. And I also mentioned in the book how if we actually hold hands with one another or give each other a hug or even get more intimate, that we're actually electromagnetically connecting even more deeply, because we literally create a circuit of energy flow electrically. And because, in sexual activity, we're very connected to each other's fluids through sweat and so on, and therefore we're literally intimately sharing heart energy, brain energy, so on and so forth. And to the extent that this energy is given in a loving fashion, we're literally boosting each other's energy, and we're synchronizing each other's energy, and we're doing this with the optimal, if you would, healing environment and healing intention. So, we would predict that that intimate relationships of a loving sort are actually a very good, not just at a social psychological level, but an energetic level as well.
Well, that may explain then why they say married men live longer than single men.
Absolutely.
Although it doesn't explain, and you know this old setup, that married women live longer than married men. And the conclusion from, you know, science, I think for years, has been verified as to why married men die first. Do you know about that? You know why married men die first?
Actually, I don't. Why?
Because they want to. Now, that's the old joke, is that they want to. But I do think that does speak to an interesting thing about the difference in how long you live if you have romance and a regular sexual partner as part of your lifestyle. All right, well, then we'll leave that there for now. We'll come back to the phone calls here, and we've just started set up. We just started coming in. So we'll get them all lined up for Dr. Gary Schwartz in just a moment. But I want to say for the end of this hour, a discussion about the future of the energy healing experiments. What do you think your book points us toward? What might we expect in the next 5 or 10 years that might change about our life based on some of these experiments coming up on Coast to Coast AM? This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Gary Schwartz, a series of books, and we can take this in all sorts of different directions, but I'll be trolling the phones for anybody who's been a transplant recipient just to see where they chime in on this research we talked about last hour on Coast to Coast AM. First-time caller line, Patricia is in FLA for Dr. Gary Schwartz on Coast to Coast AM. Patricia, go ahead.
Good evening, and what a pleasure it is to be on a radio station I've listened to for 10 years. I've never gotten through before. On a few occasions I've tried, and thank you for being able to speak to two very intelligent people.
I've listened
about the transplant, and it's not the first time I've heard about that. My own experience, though, is that my lover of 21 years died practically in my arms on January the 21st this year. She died after a long illness of 4 years with multiple sclerosis. When I was on hold, I was listening to the conversation you were having about sexual intimacy, and I think that the fact that we were so close, we raised 4 kids together, in the end, I was her caregiver, and she couldn't walk at all, and I did everything for her. So I think that part of that may explain why, after she passed, experiences of what I'll just call after-death communication have come in so strongly. We both were very spiritual, and we both tried to understand why constantly in our lives we would find such coincidences that seem to keep our family together and such evidence of life beyond in our lives all the time. After she died, I think Psychic Detectives is one of the last shows she even watched. After she died, it came through so strongly that I can only say that the meaning to me has been that it's brought her 4 children between the ages of 25 and 30, and real recognition that mom is not gone, that she is somewhere. Something that happened recently had to do with the bridge collapse, at least in terms of how I would connect it, if I could tell you that story.
Please.
Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. Every time that she has come through, and it really began just a day or two after she passed away, it's come through some kind of an electrical appliance, usually the television, sometimes the cell phone, sometimes the computer.
Wow.
I didn't even really know about what I think is encompassed in the movie White Noise, electromagnetic energy and things. I didn't even know about that. Until after she passed, and the movie just happened to land into my hands. And it's a similar way that she communicates, but it's not like talking or anything. It's just where she'll put things in my way. And about a week and a half ago, it was July 27th, I turned on the television, and it was a movie called Mothman Prophecies. Have you ever seen that?
Yes.
Yes.
So I turn on the movie, and it's very late. I'm not sure exactly what time it started in Hollywood it was not a DVD, it was a network movie. Somewhere in the movie, Richard Gere looks at his clock and he wakes up, and I knew right away it was a movie I wanted to watch because in the movie his wife has died. So when he looks at the clock, it says 6:14. I knew without looking at my clock that when I looked at my clock, it would say 6:14, which it did. I think that was really unusual because I keep my clocks 11 minutes fast. And you could verify that from the time the movie started on Channel 42 down here. I fell asleep before the end of the movie, and I didn't know what the end was. But the following days at work, I told about 7 people that I had seen the movie. I didn't know the ending, and that the 6:14 thing was significant to me, because that's the same way she's always shown me that she's around, by doing something that will be too coincidental, that is beyond what odds would be even lottery odds. So the night of the bridge collapse, her nephew came to my house, as he frequently does, and he's downloaded the Mothman prophecies for me, and he's brought it to me. And he says, you know, did you see the ending? And I said, no, I haven't seen the ending. I said, but I want to turn the TV on because there's been a bridge collapse in Minneapolis, which he didn't know about. So at the same time that he puts on the computer a movie, which is the ending of the Mothman, I'm watching a bridge collapse, and at the same time my TV is showing the bridge collapse. So I just wanted to know what you think about that type of coincidence.
Okay, well, this is most interesting. First of all, let me just be clear about a couple of things, and then I'm going to tell you a remarkable compliment to your, quote, coincidence or synchronicities, okay? First of all, you say you've been listening to Coast to Coast for 10 years. Is that correct?
I have at least three or four examples of that level of empirical data.
Okay.
And then in terms of other things, and I have been recording these since she passed.
Okay.
Over 100 instances.
Hang on, Patricia. Hang on. But don't miss the response. Go ahead, doctor.
Yeah. Patricia, first of all, I have a website called www.drgaryschwartz.com. DrGarySchwartz.com.
And I had written your name down before we even spoke.
Okay, and what I'd like you to do is, if you would, to email me some aspects of the story, because when you hear what I'm going to tell you, you're going to see that there's a connection here. But I just want to repeat, you've been listening Coast to Coast for 10 years, but this is the first time that you've called and got through. Is that correct?
I believe that's what she said,
That's what you said. And also you said, and then you had to tell the story about you know, the love with your, I presume this was your mother who passed and so on.
It was her partner.
And that after this, you began experiencing these apparent electronic-type phenomena, and then you had this remarkable synchronicity with the clock with 6:14, and then you said your clock was 11 minutes fast. Remember you said that?
Right.
Okay, now here's what I just want to share with you. In the Appendix C to a book I wrote called The G.O.D. Experiments, G period, O period, D period, which stands for Guiding, Organizing, Designing Process, with the subtitle is How Science is Discovering God in Everything, Including Us, which, by the way, would be a wonderful show at some point. The wonderful discussion is in Appendix C, buried in the back of the book, I share a story of the first of a series, which will be another book, which is called Synchronicity in New York City. And it begins with the number 11. Now, the reason why I'm commenting on this, by the way, is that my birthday is 6:14, June 14th. And so I pay attention to when I hear the numbers 6:14, because 6:14 adds up to 11. So you have a 6:14, and then you have an 11 minutes effect. And then you're talking about a synchronicity of timing that relates to an event that happened, but it actually preceded the time that the bridge actually occurred. It's just that you didn't know it. Now, in the book, The God Experiments, the first two chapters actually deal with a man called the Dream Detective in England. His name is Christopher Robinson. And Christopher Robinson, for the past 15 years, has been having what are called precognitive dreams, where he sees events, particularly terrorist events and also natural disasters, and they happen in the future. And he actually came to my laboratory, and we did what we call the 10-day in Arizona experiment, so that I could potentially verify whether or not he was actually accurately being able to perceive the future, and that we could actually measure this under controlled conditions. And I was just extraordinarily shocked by the he's sort of a Michael Jordan of precognitive dreaming, and so consequently you are actually sharing a number of things. And by the way, he reports that in his dreams, deceased people, deceased policemen that he knew, or other people will, quote, come to him in his dreams, and that's part of the way that he gets information about the future. So I'm just sharing with you that your experiences are they happen in other individuals. They can be studied, and you may be having some very extraordinary ones, and that would be worth exploring further.
I hope she gets them onto your website. I appreciate the comments. And let's go west of the Rockies, where Angelo is in Phoenix on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Gary Schwartz. Angelo?
How are you, Ian? Hello, doctor.
Hello. We're fellow Arizonans.
Yes. Doctor, back in 1999, I received a kidney transplant.
Mm-hmm.
Always, always hated diet sodas. Right after that, I had to have a diet soda, and I wake up with one and go to bed with one now.
Wow.
Was it part of your treatment that you were supposed to cut back on sugar?
Absolutely not. The doctor didn't like that at first, and after a while, he started chuckling about it. But I noticed I was always spiritual in my younger days, and then in my 20s and 30s kind of got away from that, and then more spiritual now than any time in my life I've ever been.
Hmm.
More intuitive now, and the soda is just almost eerie the way I'm so addicted to this stuff.
Let me ask you a question. Do you know anything about the person who provided you with a kidney?
Well, that happened very synchronicity-wise, like you were talking about synchronicity, and
mm-hmm.
I found out who the young man was, found out how he passed away. It was a car accident,
uh-huh.
or he was run over, actually, in Phoenix, and met his mother and his priest and got a blow-by-blow description of the night before, which I didn't like at the time. Made
right.
me feel uncomfortable. But know his name, thank him every day, and thank God for the gift.
Did he have a passion for diet drinks?
I didn't ask that, but I did find out he was a very spiritual young man.
Okay. If I were you, if it's possible,
yeah.
I would check and see whether or not he had a passion for Diet Cokes. One of the things that were diet drinks, one of the things that very often changes when people have these kinds of personality, alterations with the receiving of a kidney or a heart, is a change in food preferences. As a matter of fact, there was a book called The Change of Heart, Claire Sylvia, where she had a heart and lung transplant. And one of the most remarkable aspects of her change in food preference was she was a very health-oriented woman, okay? And yet after she had her heart and lung transplant, immediately upon leaving the hospital, she had an overwhelming urge to eat chicken McNuggets, you know,
yeah.
fried chicken, a food that she never ate before. She later learned, partly, again, synchronistically, about how she was able to find the parents of the young man who died. And he died in a motorcycle accident, and it turned out that he had a passion for chicken McNuggets. In fact, he was driving home from McDonald's, and he had uneaten pieces of chicken McNuggets in the pocket of his motorcycle jacket.
How about
when he was killed.
Doctor, I have a question for you.
Yes.
When receiving, and I'm sure there's some sort of cohesion between the cells, and I'm wondering, it like consciousness. With one person, and you receive any transplant like that, or the heart, whatever the organ might be, is it like times two?
Boy, that is a really wonderful question. And Paul Pearsall, in his book, The Heart's Code, and I talk about this a bit because this is a very serious possibility, is that since our organs are intimately connected to our consciousness when we're physically alive and in our bodies, our organs, so to speak, serve as antenna receivers for our consciousness. Just like the brain can serve as an antenna receiver for consciousness. At least that's the conclusion you come to from all of these mediumship and other kinds of near-death experience studies and so on. And therefore, it's possible that it's not just picking up the memory of the donor, but literally you're picking up the consciousness of the donor. Particularly if he's spiritual, you're spiritual, and you're having gratitude and thankfulness to this young man who provided you with a kidney.
And Angelo, it may not be that he had a passion for diet sodas, but it might be interesting to find out whether he was athletic or very health conscious, because then after the transplant of the kidney, perhaps what the kidney was saying was the kidney felt that you needed a diet soda. So maybe there was maybe there's a connection that way. So let us know when you find out.
Yeah, let us know.
You can put that either in an email to me or send it to Dr. Gary Schwartz. Let's go east of the Rockies, where Michael is hanging on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Gary Schwartz. Go ahead, Michael.
Dr. Schwartz, Americans spend twice as much on health care as the rest of the world combined, and yet they are number 46 in health and longevity. 45 other countries are doing better, and yet we spend twice as much as the whole rest of the world combined. Now, here is an illustration of one of the great follies of success, and I hope that doesn't happen to Coast to Coast. I hope it doesn't happen to Ian Punnett, because when he first came on this show, I was convinced that his introductions in the first hour to the main guest of the program marked him to be the greatest broadcaster that has ever appeared on the American scene. But he's abandoned that whole thing for this popularity contest, and as a result, he is not the number one talk show host in America. But
not that I don't appreciate the slam, which is, you know, always nice. But I mean, is there a point?
Yeah, the point is very simple.
Okay.
One of the great veterinarians of America, when he saw that the veterinary medical society was curing all of the diseases that Americans were told there were no cure for, he decided to go to medical school so that he could straighten this situation out.
Hey, Michael, that's not a point. That's the beginning of another lecture. So you're killing my ratings right now, if you want to know the truth. Sorry to disappoint you, however that has happened in the past. If this is your idea of where the show should go, maybe I can take your endorsement that I'm failing with a grain of salt. I would love to get some other comments, though, for Dr. Schwartz about his work and exactly where that'll go. We don't know, as that last call indicates. So we'll get to more questions and comments coming up next about the energy healing experiments of Dr. Schwartz on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. And I'd like to accentuate that preposition if I could. Talk with Ian Punnett, not at Ian Punnett, but be nice. Dr. Gary Schwartz, we'll get in all of your questions and comments. We'll save a few minutes at the end to talk about where the energy healing experiments will go next, what we can anticipate might come out of all of this research on the way on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Well, the wild card line has Anne in Utah, and I don't know whether she's heard anything more. Has there been anything reported locally about the fate of the miners, Anne? Last time I checked, there still wasn't a word.
No. Matter of fact, what I've heard has come through the news on your show. So
okay.
I'm a little further down. I'm down south in St. George, very southern Utah. So I'm
and,
further away from that.
Thank you for that. Here's Dr. Gary Schwartz. The book is The Energy Healing Experiments. Where do you want to go with this?
Well, I've got a transplant experience. My late husband was a kidney transplant recipient, and we did not have the privilege of knowing anything about the donor, but donors. He had more than one transplant, but he could describe. He could describe this woman, and he felt like if he had seen a picture of her, he would be able to recognize her, and her presence was very positive and a nice person, and actually he enjoyed her company, if you will. It wasn't a spooky thing, he said, to have, and she was around him quite. He felt her presence from time to time with him, and that was a positive one. Then he had another transplant, and that one didn't last. You know, it lasted quite a while, but I several years, but then it was failing, and so he had another one. And this experience was not a good one. He said, and it wasn't because that I don't believe it was a psychological thing where he didn't want the transplant. I mean, we all know about dialysis. It's not something you really look forward to. And a transplant is just a wonderful experience and changes your life. But he did not feel right about this one. He felt that this person, whoever it was just brought bad energy to him from the moment that he felt this in him. He said it felt like something that he didn't want the presence of. And the organ eventually did reject, and he was very relieved when they surgically removed it.
Dr. Schwartz, questions, thoughts?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's very rare to hear about more than one transplant, and for a person to be sensitive enough to discriminate the differences. I agree with you. It would have been precious if you could have actually known details about either one of these individuals. Was your husband how is it that he was open to being able to have these experiences and not be frightened of them?
I think we just were that kind of person. I mean, that a little, quite very. He's very intuitive, and I do think that was just part of who he is and part of who I am. You know, sensing energies and presences and things.
Was he a grateful person?
Grateful, I think he was for this. On this, he was very grateful for this to this donor.
Hmm. Very interesting.
But he was a very. Risk taker and a very active person and mm-hmm. bold and with a lot of energy and an out of the box type thinker.
An out of the box kind of thinker. Well, that would make sense. Intuitive, out of the box, and yet brave enough to be able to try these things and try on new ideas too.
And after that first transplant, willing to hold your purse while you're shopping, which is kind of a nice change too. Well, thank you. Wildcard line. Patrick is in Texas. On Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Gary Schwartz. Patrick?
Hello, Gary.
Hi.
Really am interested in what you're saying, and I had childhood experiences that my mom taught me, and it was all about she'd write short stories, and she'd paint the walls, and she'd include us in the stories before we go to bed and hold them on her lap, and she'd put us to bed. And then she'd put, like, sand in the bed or leaves in the bed to convince us that we actually had experiences out of our bodies.
Wow.
And she did a lot of things like this to expand our mental capacity to understand full spirituality. And I turned at 18 months to what would later, in 1953, be called autism. And I turned around at 13,
mm-hmm.
but I spent most of those years observing people and feeling them. And it was a remarkable thing that I have to this day. I have extremely sensitive feelings about energy.
Uh-huh.
Can this be taught?
What a wonderful question. And it's a very important one, and the answer is yes. It turns out that we even report an experiment in the Energy Healing Experiments book where fellows, these are physicians and also other healthcare practitioners, who took part in a 5-day energy healing training course with Rosalind Briere. She's a very famous energy healer. And the fellows, by the way, were part of Andrew Weil's program in integrative medicine. And what we did was we actually tested these practitioners pre and post this 5-day training in their capacity to actually objectively detect their percent accuracy energy coming from another person. The details you can find in the book. And what we found is not only did the group as a whole improve in their ability to detect energy after the training, but there were individual differences. And one of the predictors of who actually learned the best was something called openness to experience, the openness to scale. And it's also called the absorption scale. And it has to do with the extent to which people are sensitive to their environments and become absorbed in it. You know, like, for example, you read a book and you get totally lost in it, or you're listening to music and you become one with the music, or you experience a sunset, and, you know, you just become feel very connected to it. And people who are more likely to feel connected and become absorbed in things were actually more likely to benefit from the actual training in energy detection and energy healing. So, yes, I do believe that this is something that all of us can do, because we're all ultimately energy beings. And we have all this latent talent waiting to be discovered and developed.
Let's go to Joseph Wildcard Line in Cleveland on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Gary Schwartz. Joseph?
Hello. I'm actually myself an energy healer, just amateur. The way I started was I had cancer, stage four, and my brother gave me a book. You might know of it. Kenneth Cohen's Light of Qigong.
Yes.
Art and Science of Energy Healing.
Yes.
I learned exactly what you're talking about. In fact, I understand more because of your interview here, that the movement, circular and such, is how people can learn to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And I have two friends that have fibromyalgia, and also one is crippled with RA, arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And I do this work as a favor. I do this type of helping with their pain management. And I keep telling them, look, you can learn this yourself. It's also self-healing.
Yes.
I can't feel nothing. And I do have, I guess, a gift for it. I
mm-hmm.
can feel energy moving through me. I can manipulate theirs. But the thing I did a couple of times, which I learned 20 years ago from Black Belt Magazine, was a teacher who had students pull muscles and rip tendons. She would pull pain away. And I tried this. I actually pulled the one friend who has RA fevers, I pulled away her fever. She felt it like fire moving up her back, and then she felt better because she gets miserable and her pain. I couldn't do anything to project energy to touch the pain. I pulled it away, and sure enough, the pain lessened.
That's very interesting.
And
Dr. Schwartz,
wondering if you had done it. The studies on that.
Yes, the answer is yes. And I've also, by the way, learned various energy healing techniques myself, and I now practice various forms of what I call energy self-care. And one of the take-home messages in the book is that we're actually all energy healers. We all have this capacity. And some of us, have a natural talent for singing or music or athletics. Some of us have a greater talent than this than others, but all of us can learn to play chopsticks on the piano, for example, or learn to speak. And I think all of us have the capacity to develop our energy healing skills. And I think it's what you're saying is very, very important. I'm really glad that you shared it with us.
Very interesting. Dell, Wildcard Line on Coast to Coast AM for Dr. Gary Schwartz from Venice, right, Dell?
That's it. I'm from Venice, yeah. Ian, I think you're the greatest. And Dr. Schwartz, my dad was born on 6/14.
Oh, that's special. What year?
1889. He was an old man, a long time ago. And I'm in my middle 60s, so I'm getting pretty old myself.
Gotcha.
Anyway, I'm a student of A Course in Miracles. And I started, when I was meditating, I saw this beautiful blue color. And, being a painting contractor, after seeing the color for, a couple of weeks and meditating, daily meditating, I decided to make that color. And when I made the color, I realized that was me. It was my vibration.
Hmm.
So I developed a meditation system, a color meditation system for people that have problems. I've been working with women that have PTSD from being raped and molested and so forth. And right now, I'm working with those Marines who are coming back from Iraq with PTSD.
Oh,
and
good.
It's working really well.
Good, good, good.
And the question I've got for you, Doctor, I'm sorry, I hope I'm not demeaning you calling you Doc.
No, no, Doc is good.
Okay, Doctor, I've done a lot of study of the human brain.
Okay.
And I know that our brain is animalistic, that we have the brain of an animal.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I've got is, where in this animal's brain do we store all this massive amounts of intelligence that we as humans have? I mean, like Ian was talking about intuition, and, we have imagination. We have all these different things that make us human. Where do we store all that information in the brain?
Well, that's a great question, okay? Before I answer it, I have to just compliment you about something. Not just the fact that your father was born on 6/14, but also I would like to say that I also think that Ian is the greatest.
That's very nice.
But I'm really serious about this. It's so rare to be able to be interviewed and to be interviewed in depth with someone who's playful, who's thoughtful, who asks searching questions, who's not only a good listener but a good sharer, and is and represents the totality of the work in a comprehensive fashion. I mean, this is just, for me, a delight. So I just want, I want Ian to know, because we have never met before, and your audience to know how much I deeply appreciate the communication.
I want to say I agree with Michael that I suck, but I would I would have disagreed with his criteria. I don't think it's because my introductions have gotten worse. That's all I'm saying. I think there's lots of reasons to say I'm not good at this, but I think my introductions are great. So I don't know about that. But
yeah, I can't speak to this because, to be honest, I've never heard your show before, so I only have one experience at this moment. But I'm just telling you, but from this limited experience, you suck very delicious candy or whatever it is.
Okay. Well, thank you. Okay. I'll put that on my business card.
Okay. Now, getting back to the caller's question, I think that the comment is actually a deep one, and that I think that I don't know how to address it in a precise way. Is the caller still on?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Would you specify exactly what you'd like me to answer?
Well, you know, I found out I'm working with vibration,
right?
And I found out that everything that vibrates generates a color,
right?
Okay, so we all vibrate, and since we vibrate, we all have a unique color,
right?
All right. The problem I'm having, you know, especially with women that have been molested and raped and so forth, is that they have so much thought in front of everything.
Right.
And so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get around this specific thought and get right to the core of the thing, get to the amygdala and the thalamus and so forth.
Let me address this. I think that in some sense our animal brain can sometimes get the better of us, particularly if we've been traumatized. And so in the case of PTSD, for example, there really is circuitry, you know, for example, in the amygdala that has to be addressed. However, the deeper question, which is what makes us human and how do we bring the humanness to alter the machinery of our anatomy, I've actually come to the conclusion, and this is based on 10 years of research, particularly with research mediums, not fake mediums, not fraud, deceptive people, but people who are actually doing this work in a responsible fashion. And there are a few. There aren't too many, but there are a few. I've come to the conclusion that actually most of what we think of as what makes us human and also what is where that information is stored is not, quote, in the brain or even in the body, but it's actually stored in energy fields outside the body. Now, I just think about the following. You know, if you could imagine going out into space and looking out in all directions, wherever you'd look, you'd see stars. And also, if you had telescopic vision, you'd be seeing distant galaxies in all directions. And this information is coming to you from all directions, and this information is representing the history of these stars and these galaxies for billions of years. And all that information, you know, you talk about how many angels in the head of a pin. Think about all of the trillions and trillions and trillions of pieces of information that are coming in all directions that are passing through in the so-called, quote, vacuum of space. When you really think about the physics of photons from an information point of view, you realize that the universe is a gigantic information storage system.
And you know what, I'm going to, because I want to leave a minute and a half here to talk about where this research is going to take you. So
sure.
I'll just say then, reiterate to Dell that what you're talking about is the outside, the exterior perhaps is where he ought to look for that. But in the time that we have, and since I promised it, can you take us a minute and a half into the future and tell us where you think these healing experiments are going to lead?
They're going to lead in many directions. First of all, there's actually going to be the evolution of new technology. These are actual devices that can measure the energy fields outside of the body. so that we're going to be able to see changes in energy before they're manifest in the physical. And this technology is being developed in various parts of the world, and it's something that when we look into our, you know, our predictive crystal ball, I think it's going to continue to unfold. Secondly, we're going to discover how these techniques are going to be used to either avoid certain kinds of surgeries or drugs, or complement and enhance surgery and drugs with the aid of these techniques. Also, children are going to be taught these techniques very early, just like learning to brush your teeth or learning to exercise. Children are going to become ever more aware of their energetic nature and their essence, and they're going to be able to develop skills so that people are going to be able to engage not only in self-care but the care of others. Also, there's going to be a transformation in consciousness, because when people start thinking of themselves instead of being, quote, material beings, but in sense experience of ourselves as energetic beings, and that we're all interconnected via this this energetic matrix.
And I love all of that. I love all of that, and I hope that all of that turns out to be true, because that should give us all hope for the future. The energy healing experiments, science reveals our natural power to heal. Dr. Gary Schwartz, let's go ahead and pencil in a visit sometime in the fall to get back to the topics we didn't get to tonight.
That would
good?
Be wonderful. Let's do it, Ian.
And I thank you so much, too, for your kind comments. And for Dell, too, I hope that he'll pick up a copy of this book and think about what more he can do for those victims. And for everybody out there in pain tonight, too, perhaps this is a hope for you as well. In the meantime, Deus te amat, and I do, too.